All right. So this is the first talk in a series on the 10 paramis. And it's a summary of the whole field of the paramis. And the title of the talk today is How We Are is Who We Are. How We Are is Who We Are. So the paramis are basically qualities, ways of being, or our how we are's personality as a person within our world of Dharma. And you could, in Hebrew, be ma'alot or skulot or midot, something like that. But it has in it a quality of the perfection of these qualities. They are perfect qualities in potential. Para is beyond. Para. Parama is beyond, more, higher. And parami or paramita is the perfection of the qualities. And it's really about how we live after we practice and when we practice Dharma. How is it, what do we do when we get up in the morning? And it's perfection because if there's less reactivity as a me, as a self, as a conditioned subject, then life is different. And there's really, the example I can give is the Eightfold Path. Because the Eightfold Path is a way of training. But the Noble Eightfold Path is what happens after you have already passed through experiences in which the self is less important. You already know the transparency of the self. Ashkifut. You already know something, to some extent. You don't take yourself so seriously, in other words. You're not so full of self-importance. Then how do you act? So the Eightfold Path is training and right speech, for example, and the Noble Eightfold Path is how you speak when you've done 10 retreats, 20 retreats. How do you speak then? And the paramis are the same. They are qualities when we're less full of attachment and automatic living and reactivity and suffering in samsara, then how we are. And it needs attention, especially in the Western world where we've put retreats and meditation as rather high. And then it's quite usual that we get up in the morning and say, look, I've done 20 retreats, but I'm still as angry. I'm still angry. How is that possible that I'm still angry after 20 retreats? And that's a bit of a misunderstanding, because we have to look very carefully at our personality and see what's happened because of the 20 retreats. And sometimes we just don't notice. We don't notice because the struggle of life takes us over. And that's why we had that introduction at the beginning. And several of you, for example, said, I lack equanimity. I've done many retreats, but I need more equanimity. Great. That's fine, but we need, as a parami, this is one of the equanimities, one of the paramis, we need to look and see, maybe there's more equanimity in us than we realize, if we pay attention to how we are as a person. And that's the power of the paramis. And I have to say that there's an illusion that enlightenment is an awakening is something, and it's not something. And as Suzuki said, there's no enlightened person, there's only an enlightened action. So this puts the emphasis on how we are as enlightened action in life, rather than having a goal called climbing up the mountain of bliss and emptiness. And when we're on top of the mountain, we're somehow enlightened. It puts the emphasis on the enlightened moment is how we are with ourselves and the world in the moment. So, all the paramis are connected one to another. It's obvious that they're not standing alone. For example, the parami of ethics, sila, has to be connected to the parami of panya, wisdom. Because if we're not ethical, then the wisdom doesn't work. And if we're not wise, the ethics don't work. So we develop ethics, we develop wisdom, we develop equanimity, we develop calm, we develop energy, we develop honesty and truth. They're all connecting to each other. Each one of the paramis helps the other. And I'm just reminded of a story that I've told many times, but just such a nice story from the Talmud of about the way these things work together. It was Yom Kippur, and someone, a student said, I must apologize to a butcher, Katzav, that I hurt him verbally. And the teacher said, don't go there. It's not wise. He said, no, I must apologize. I have to do it. I feel bad. I had said something wrong to him. And he went to the butcher, and he rushed into the door and said, I must apologize I hurt you. And he disturbed the butcher in the moment of cutting a bone, and a splinter went into the body of the butcher and killed him. So he had exactly the opposite result, because he lacked the wisdom, but he had the wanting to repair something. But just a small example of how everything is fitting together. So if we, all the practice, slowly, we peel defilements or kilesas or hindrances, which I won't go into now, but you've had enough Dharma to know what they are or something about them, hindrances of selfing, restlessness, desire, aversion, confusion, illusion, selfing, ego, resistance, angers, etc., etc. Peeling, bit by bit, and letting go of qualities that give us pain and suffering, and give us and other people. And all the practices keep doing that. And as we do that, we actually become a slightly different person. The personality begins to shine in a new way. We don't go on retreat to say, I want to be a different person. But as we peel off the resistances and the automatic behaviors and the conditioned pain that we've received all our life from childhood, and all the smacks we've got from life that make us contracted, and all the conditioning that makes us attached and live automatically, tayas automatic. So as we drop them, bit by bit we peel them, a different personality shines. What is that personality? That's the paramis. And so we go through a cycle of practice. For example, we go on a retreat, we're there on a retreat a week, we come out, we don't work in the retreat on our personality. We work in the retreat on quiet, on calm, on centering, on being aware, and on letting stuff come up. The hindrances, for example, restlessness, letting it come up and dissolving, letting restlessness come up and dissolving, or letting anger come up and dissolving, or letting desire come up and dissolving, or letting emotional pain come up and dissolving. We don't work on personality. But at the end of that cycle, we are a bit different, even though we might not notice it. And so we can feel that there's cycles of practice that result in a different, slightly different personality. And that personality moves towards awakening. So there's an image in the traditional Theravada world of this, which is the Jataka tales. And the Jataka tales are stories of the Buddha being born again and again and again and again in this world as a body, and each time, each cycle, learning a different parami. So it's taken on a mythological level. The Jataka tales are the folk stories. Actually, some of you may have the book Buddha at Bedtime for Children. And they're the Jataka tales. And it's very, very traditional in the Buddhist world. That's what people read. And the tales are where the Buddha learns every cycle a lesson that teaches him about a parami. And so we can feel we're going through cycles, and maybe the cycle is retreats. Maybe the cycle is something we do personally. A cycle can be a morning practice. We go through the cycle and something stays. Something is released. And we're slightly different. And at that point a learning has happened and something on the personality has shifted. And the paramis are always about daily life. They're always the way we are. They're not, and I purposely wanted the meditation this morning to be very open and very free. As almost a demonstration, we had a circle, we talked about personality issues, what we missed, and I wanted to have a meditation which is missing nothing, which is totally free and perfect, and to have the two talk to each other. So as we get up in the morning, go out to daily life, who are we? But the meditation we have in the morning does something to that. So there's 10 Theravada paramis and 6 Mahayana paramis. The 10 Theravada paramis I've already sent you. You've got them in English and Hebrew. And I'm sending another one through Gidon this week, which gives a little bit more explanation on each one, or a few words. And there's 6 Mahayana, that's Tibetan paramis. And the interesting thing is that Tibetans have this image of the hand. It comes from the Tibetan tradition. Maybe it's very ancient, I don't know. With the eye in the middle, Khamsa. That's very ancient, thousands of years old. And the eye in the middle is wisdom. Because the eye of wisdom is in a way central to everything. Without wisdom, nothing works. Wisdom is the wisdom of freedom and awakening. So there's the eye in the middle. And then the 5 fingers are generosity, ethics, patience, energy, and concentration or determination. So that's the 6 paramis in the Mahayana or Tibetan tradition. And that's the picture of them. And in the Theravada tradition, in addition to those 6, there is renunciation, truthfulness, which I think is better translated as authenticity, love of truth, loving kindness, and equanimity. That's 4 more. I think we should be interested in them because they are ways in which we check ourselves as well. And it's often quite difficult to actually say, where am I actually on the journey? So, how do you do that? And it's really nice to have as usual in the Dharma, you have all these lists, and you have a kind of a teaching which is quite structured, and the paramis are one of them. So we can check ourselves. How is it for me now? I gave you a small example, a personal example on truth and truthfulness and honesty. I've told this story before, but because there's a camera, I'm going to say it again. It hasn't been there before. I remember as a parent, I used to write notes to the school when my daughter didn't want to go to school, which was most of the time. And so I was quite happy to write notes for her. And at the beginning I wasn't practicing so much. It was quite a few years ago. So I was quite happy to lie. She's sick today. Can't go to school today. Actually, she was playing happily in the garden. And well, that was I kind of couldn't do that anymore. I just couldn't lie like that. It wasn't possible anymore. But it was possible to kind of smear it and have a kind of a half a lie to Kibbutz Kabri school and sort of, well, she doesn't feel right, she's not able to go today. Words like that I can just sort of, more or less without lying crudely. You call in English a white lie. That was it. Yeah. But then I practiced more and more, and even that wasn't right. After a few more retreats, there's no way. She was still at school. It didn't take so long. I couldn't lie anymore. So I just wrote notes saying, she doesn't want to go to school today. And I was ready to take the consequences. Let the police come. I couldn't lie anymore. It just doesn't work. And I think, we all maybe have this, if we look at that, it's a way of keeping track of how we are in our life. And keeping, the paramis are a way of keeping track of, in a way, measuring how we are and how our spiritual journey is working for us and changing us. But we really, really need, with measuring, we really need to let go and understand that it's not reliable. We can't expect karma to work on us in a certain way. With this checking or measuring, we have to also be very, very free and let go. And how many people have come to me in retreats and said, look, I've been going 8 retreats, 9 retreats, 10 retreats, and all of a sudden my body hurts, my knee hurts, my back hurts, just like the first retreat. I don't understand. What am I doing wrong? It should have gone by now. Or, like we're saying, daily life. I've done all these retreats, 10 retreats, 12 retreats. I've been in a monastery in Burma. I've done walking meditation 12 hours a day. And when I come back, like Jack Kornfield says, when I come back to the West and meet my mother, it's as if I've gone back to Kita Aleph, the first square one again. And I think that we can't measure, we can't expect, we can look at things wisely, but we can't expect karma to work for us in a certain way. Karma has its own rules, it's much bigger than us. And the second a thing about measuring, besides the kind of letting go into the unexpected and the uncontrolled and the undesigned and the unborn, as the Buddha would say. The second thing about measuring is that we need to be more subtle about how we measure. I mean, for example, renunciation is a parami, vitur. And we're liable to sort of look at ourselves and say, oh, I'm still like I am. I'm still need that. I'm still stuck with TV every evening. I'm still addicted to cigarettes, or I'm still, in other words, my renunciation doesn't work. I'll leave that parami and I'll be interested in something else like loving kindness. Because that parami isn't, no, I'm a desire type. I'm stuck with attachment to something. But we should understand that when we look at something like renunciation, it's much bigger than how addicted we are to something or not. Renunciation can be our ability to sit quietly without anything missing. Vitur. Renunciation is vitur. It may be just that, which we forgot, because it's too simple. I can sit quietly with nothing missing. And I couldn't do that 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I would sit quietly and immediately I want to open Idiot Akra or not and see what's going on in the news. I would turn on the radio. I couldn't sit quietly with nothing happening. Now I can. Nothing needs to happen. Sit under a tree. That's renunciation. Because I'm not missing anything. I'm not hungry for filling up the holes in me anymore, or less. But yes, you might still have anger, and you might still have this and this and this. So we have to understand a bit more deeply these qualities and look at them more subtly, more deeply. And we'll do that in this course, taking each one and looking at it more deeply to see, and then maybe we'll discover, well, I've got it. It's a delight. Yeah, I'm pretty well renounced. But okay, I still smoke cigarettes. All right, that's still there. But this, I'm still sitting like my cat sits in a chair for 1 hour. We may see ourselves as less critical and not realize that it's the movement of loving kindness. But if we do see more clearly loving kindness and not put it as, well, the Buddha said I have to love everybody and I don't, and I'm annoyed by the Prime Minister and I'm annoyed by my neighbor and I'm annoyed by, yes, but wait a minute, maybe we are putting a misunderstanding metta as loving kindness. Maybe loving-kindness is actually just our ability to allow things to be what they are. A bit more ability to allow things to be what they are. Less itnagdut on everything. So that's something, that's what we need to learn here and learn in our life. Now, I mentioned karma, and karma is just the arrival of qualities and events, and how we are with these qualities and events. And the paramis are, in a way, the result of karma, because how our personality is built is not in our hands. It's conditioned from life. So life might have made us critical, loving, angry, um, restless, tall, small, thin, fat, whatever. Life put us in a certain genetics. Life put us in a with certain parents. We dropped into a body. We're not in control of what kind of body. So that's karma. And the paramis are the result of karma, but they also change karma. Because karma is built and continues in us because of avidya, meaning automatic living, non-awareness. Non-awareness, a sense of living automatically, makes sure that karma continues. There's nothing to stop it. As we are, automatically we will keep producing ourselves. Everything will confirm who we are. We won't have anything to change ourselves. But the practice, and especially the practice of the understanding the paramis, the qualities, they change our karma. Because when our qualities change, we are sowing different seeds in the world. And most of the seeds that we sow in the world are spontaneous. They're not designed. Because just think, 24 hours, how many words we say? How many looks in the eyes? How much we radiate to the world? Mishader, mefazer, that's meaning. We just throw ourselves out into the world. We're not aware of what we do to the world. But all the time we're influencing the world. World influencing us, but we keep spreading seeds, throwing seeds, millions, millions, every day. And most of it is automatic or spontaneous. We don't know that we're doing it. And so, building different qualities of being, of personality, changes the seeds we sow in the world. This we can be aware of. And spontaneously, different things will happen. Karma will be changed. Small example of my story about lying and truthfulness. Something is changed in the world, a small thing, by being truthful and not lying. Something will be changed. Karma, my karma also, but other people's too. Something will be shifted. We can't predict it, we don't know how it will happen, we can't design karma. But the paramis, then means the qualities of being will shift our karma, will shift what happens to us in life. Because life is all the time echoing what we throw out to it. The seeds we throw are the fruits that we tend to be the fruits we get. So life is echo, boomerang. And if we throw different seeds of awareness and of qualities of being, which is daily life qualities, then the karma that we get back is liable to be different, although we can't control it. And it's and in this sense, we are channels for karma. We are like a channel. Things pass through us. Karma passes through us. I want to go to a bit more subtle place and about the paramis. I want to talk a little bit more about the ultimate, the side of the ultimate. Because we are made of, we are spiritual beings. And we struggle. And we schlep along in life. But we're also spiritual beings. We have ki'ilu Buddha nature. Never mind what the argument whether we have or we don't have. Let's say I'm using it as an image. Okay? We have purity. And then we find ourselves attached and rather in a small life. The meeting point between ultimacy, the hamuchlat, if you like, the ultimate, the absolute, the beyond, and the way we live, the attachments, are the paramis. It's where the purity or the beyond comes through us into life. And it's an interesting reflection. How does the beyond, how does the ultimate freedom manifest in a conditioned life? So in that sense, we're a channel of the ultimate, of the beyond, of the unlimited, channeling it into daily life, which is conditioned. And the paramis are the meeting point there between the unlimited and the limited. And you can feel it in the, when we talk about those qualities. These are higher qualities that, you know, any philosopher or professor of Western professor would say, these are values. Even in the Western world, I don't want to go into it, but there's a certain holiness about these values. You read Western mystics, Western philosophers. A small example just jumps to mind. Matspun, conscience, is taken in the Western Protestant world as being holy, as being God going through us. It's one of the paramis, namely ethics. So there is there this dialogue between the ultimate and the relative, and the paramis are right in the middle of that. And that's really an interesting place. I mean, you can keep reflecting on that. So in some senses, we are bringing down the ultimate, hamuchlat. We are bringing it down. Although, don't take my images too seriously. It's their language. It's metaphor, okay? So there's no down and up in an absolute sense. There isn't such a thing. So just remember that I'm using metaphors. Okay, images. But it's an image. We're bringing down the ultimate into life, into ordinary life, through these qualities. At the same time, these are also skills. These are also skills to handle our life. They are what you call upaya, skillful means. I mean, teaching Dharma. You can't really do it without paramis. It doesn't work. And it takes a skill to teach Dharma. Skill of being non-attached, being kind, being non-argument, not fighting, not resisting. And someone, I said this before, I think it was Jack, said to be a Dharma teacher is not to give a wonderful talk, but if you give the worst talk you ever give in your life, it's to get up and come down off the stage and not have one thought about it. That's a skill in life. If you hurt somebody, what is it going around your mind? Or are you free? You hurt somebody or somebody hurt you. What next? These are skills which we navigate in life. And they are skills on different levels. They are skills of how we are qualities, but they're inner skills of inner freedom, of harmony, of emptiness. So that's a skill, to live with emptiness. How do you do that? The paramis are skills of living, how we navigate in daily life. And one of the, I think, fundamental truths about the paramis, or fundamental movements, is that they give a sense that Everything is workable. There's no life situation which is impossible. It can be the most difficult situation, and there are people here in this room that have had huge, huge pain and loss. Huge pain and loss. And I won't go into it. But in this room, people have had the most painful experiences that you can imagine. But what next? Feel the pain, and then, how are you with that? Do you keep going with it? Do you keep cycling around it? Do you become a victim all your life? Do you drown? Where are you with it? What happens next? How do you project it onto other people? How do you project it on yourself? The image in the Mahayana tradition of someone that is dancing and having purified the paramis is, of course, the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva is the image of a person who, you can call it, the translation of a Bodhisattva would be an awakener, someone that awakens others. Someone that is, his task in life is to be a kind of spiritual activist, going through life and awakening and helping selflessly without any limit. And all the paramis are matured in the Bodhisattva. There's no limit to the Bodhisattva's loving kindness. There's no limit to the Bodhisattva's equanimity. Can take all the suffering in the universe and is it still okay and not destroyed by it. There's no limit to the Bodhisattva's calm and selfless qualities. There's no limit to his renunciation, he or she. He's not at all concerned with the comfort zone. There's no limit to the wisdom. It's an inspiration for us of what happens. The Bodhisattva is an inspiration of what happens when all these paramis are really matured. And in a small way, we are all little baby bodhisattvas. We are. Although, you know, if you take bodhisattva as being too big and too high and too holy, when I said that to one Dharma teacher was quite negative to me. He said, how can you say that? The bodhisattva is so high, we're not baby bodhisattvas here. No, it's not true. It's not true. Everybody here, just in a very simple way, everybody here would help somebody who fell down in the street, or an older person. Everybody here would help a wounded animal. Everybody here responds to their children or their friend in need. Everybody here has wisdom, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting here together listening. You would just say, oh, not interesting. You're here listening because there's wisdom already there. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. If you look at the qualities, we are baby bodhisattvas. And it's a beautiful image. The bodhisattva vow, the vow, is huge. It's beyond the beyond. We can't even imagine this vow, because it's so... The vow is shavua. We can't even imagine it because it's so high. I will say what it is, but it's a ritual that in the Mahayana tradition a lot of practitioners take it every day, whether they're lamas or they're just people in the households in Tibet. Sentient beings, yitzurim, aware beings, are without number, numberless. I vow to liberate all of them. Delusions are endless. I vow to go beyond all, to transcend all of them. Dharma teachings are boundless, limitless. I vow to understand them. The Buddha Dharma is supreme teaching. I vow to live it. So I want to suggest that this vow, the Bodhisattva vow, is, we don't take it in a linear way, that because I take this vow, I have to do that. Because it's impossible, it's beyond the beyond. But if we think a little bit about what is beyond in us, our own Buddha nature, our own innate freedom, our own innate means built-in sense of spaciousness, of ultimacy, then it's an invitation to the beyond to arrive in our life. That's what it is. The Bodhisattva vow is simply an invitation, a reminder for the ultimate. These sentences are about endlessness. They're about no limit. It's an invitation for that no limit to arrive. And if we keep reminding ourselves the limitless coming down into our life, that's what the Bodhisattva vow does. Just giving us some sense of reminders. To embody the teachings in our body, and the teachings are vast indeed, and beautiful, and in a way the paramis, the qualities of the personality, they make us beautiful. They are what will and do make us beautiful. And they make, if we watch the sunset, or we watch the sky, the clouds in the sky, the sunset and the clouds in the sky are beautiful, but the watcher is beautiful too. In a way, the sunset watches us and says, you are beautiful as well. And actually the beauty that we express and we feel, and we, sometimes we miss it and sometimes we don't feel it, doesn't matter. But slowly, slowly these paramis of the ways of being make us beautiful and make us shining, and that's their blessing. Thank you. So we'll take a couple of minutes of quiet. While we're just quiet, I want to read a poem by Milarepa. And just, if we close our eyes and just feel this poem which describes the 10 paramis in a deep way. Perfectly give up belief in any true existence. There is no other generosity than this. Perfectly give up deceit and falseness. There is no other discipline. Perfectly go beyond all fear of emptiness. There is no other patience. Perfectly remain inseparable from the practice. There is no other determination. Perfectly stay in the natural flow. There is no other concentration, meditation. Perfectly realize the natural state of things. There is no other wisdom. perfectly see Dharma in everything you do. There are no other skillful means. Perfectly accomplish the double goal, liberation of self and others. There is no further aspiration. Recognize the very source of all negativity and negative emotions. There is no other basic wisdom. Let's just take a minute. Thank you.